Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media here in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. I suspect if you read newspapers and get on the internet, you know that a lot of recent research is fairly regularly demonstrating a link between health and sleep. This is true even in children, where it's not only being linked to health, but learning and school performance. So our topic today is pediatric sleep. And for the second time on the program, we've asked Dr. Ross Dodge, who's an Anchorage pediatric sleep specialist, to help us understand some of these issues. Dr. Dodge is board certified in internal medicine and also in sleep medicine, and is currently the medical director for sleep medicine at Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson. Besides doing that, he also sees patients of all ages for sleep issues at Peak Neurology here in Anchorage. Ross, welcome once again to Line One.
Well, I'm glad to be here, and I really appreciate the invitation.
During the program, if you have questions or comments, let me give you a couple of quick ways to get a hold of us. You can reach us directly with a phone call by calling 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email address is lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line one, all one word, at alaskapublic.org. And we also have a toll-free phone number, 1-888-353-5752. Ross, let's start by talking about sleep. What do we know about sleep that's pertinent for us to use as a base for discussion today? And then if you want to tell me why we sleep, that'd be glad, be nice, too.
Sure. Well, sometimes the lack thereof is what I am concerned most about. But, and I was reading a couple of definitions in the last couple of days getting ready for the program, and I came across a definition that sleep is a period in which you have behavioral quiescence and a decreased response to environmental stimuli. And I kind of paused for a second and I thought, well, I don't even understand what that means. And my impression of sleep, as I've practiced over the past couple of years, is that sleep is what allows you to become and to be who you are during the day. And what I mean by that is our daytime behaviors, our emotional responses, our overall physical health are directly linked to both the quantity and the quality of sleep that we get the night beforehand. So, you know, I think sleep is far more than just a period in which you don't react to things around you, and I think it's more of this construction of who you are and how you operate during the day.
Okay. And probably everyone who stays up on sleep a little bit knows there's different phases of sleep. Can we talk about those briefly and their significance?
Yeah, sure. Certainly. I think it's really useful to go back to the early 1950s when a guy by the name of Dr. William Dement was doing some studies, actually initially with dreaming in the dream state, and they had just begun to evaluate brain waves with what's called an EEG or an electroencephalogram. And what they noticed is that during the night, there were lots of different types of patterns of brain waves that were observed. And of course, prior to this, the thought was generally that when you went to sleep, you closed your eyes and you woke up the next day, and there wasn't a whole lot that was actively happening within the brain in between. And so medical student Dement, now Dr. Dement at the time, then went in during one of these sleep studies with the flashlight to try and figure out what was going on with either the placement of his leads or the physical display that the patient had. And what he found was that the eyeballs, so underneath the eyelids, were actively moving periodically throughout the night. And that then led to the discovery that sleep itself is not a single state, but actually a pattern of different stages of sleep, which is differentiated as non-REM sleep and REM sleep, that cycles every, in adults, about 90 minutes or so. And so that greatly broadened the field of sleep medicine, and lots more research that has followed since.
And the REM, R-E-M, was for the rapid eye movement that he was noticing.
Exactly. And some of my favorite medical descriptions are when it just states exactly what it is that you are seeing. So yes, so REM stands for rapid eye movement sleep.
All right. Let me remind listeners once again, you're listening to Line One, your health connection. My guest today is Dr. Ross Dodge. He's a pediatric sleep specialist here in Anchorage. If you've got questions or comments, this would be the time to give us a call. Our local number, 550-8433. Our email address, line1 at alaskapublic.org. and our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. Well, just unembargoed today, I believe, the American Academy of Pediatrics just came out with some guidelines on sleep. We're not going to go through all of the guidelines, but what do you think we maybe ought to mention from those guidelines?
So duration. So the key to the guidelines that were released today, which is actually an endorsement by the Academy of Pediatrics for some already published recommendations from the Academy of Sleep Medicine, was how long should your child sleep? And guidelines for duration of sleep time are pretty well known from birth all the way up through adulthood. But what this clarified was that the majority of people in America of all ages probably do not get enough total sleep time per night. Or you could also describe it as per 24-hour period. So what the guidelines essentially say is the younger the patient, the more sleep you need. And I think what's key to mention for these recent guidelines is that adolescents and that kind of key developmental age probably need significantly more sleep than they are getting, upwards of about 9 hours per night for your teenager between the ages of 13 and 18.
All right. So let's pretend that I'm a mother or a father now. I have some children, and I'll give you some problems. How about if my child won't go to bed at night? I have trouble getting him into bed. When he goes to bed, he doesn't go to sleep. Does this mean he have a sleep disorder?
So probably one of the most common questions that I get in my office, and what is concerning or what worries parents and brings them to me, is whether or not a difficult to get to sleep child has more than just I don't want to go to bed, but if it could be reflective of an underlying medical problem. And so I can provide reassurance for you, speaking to all the parents out there, is that the large majority of kids, pediatric patients who have difficulty with bedtime routines, do not have a underlying medical condition. And so the way to think about why kids would have difficulty falling asleep would be to consider that sleep is actually a transition between wakefulness and sleep onset. And the difficult part for kids is to find an association that allows them to do that. So essentially, it takes a long time for a young patient to know or to learn how to actually fall asleep. So what an adult would take for granted, I'm tired, I go into the bedroom, turn off the lights and fall asleep, can actually be a pretty unnerving and disorienting scenario for a pediatric patient. And so when they resist bedtime or they become hyperactive or they are constantly getting up afterwards, it's not necessarily that you just have a child that is out there to frustrate you. It's that they're having trouble figuring out how exactly to let their brain put them to sleep. And I think this is probably a good point to talk about some of the management for these initial bedtime behaviors. And that would be with a consistent approach and with an object that can be recognized as the key to associate that patient will use to associate with the initiation of sleep. The Academy of Pediatrics has some great routines that you can find online. If you were to Google bedtime routine for the Academy of Pediatrics, also through the American Academy of Sleep Medicine and the National Sleep Foundation. But the key theme through all of these recommendations is that it needs to be a consistent pattern. It needs to be limited in duration, so you don't want your nighttime routine to go upwards of 45 minutes or an hour, and you need to make sure that it's consistent regardless of the day of the week.
What about screens and videos and TVs and activities before sleep? This is something that, at least in our office, we have gotten in the habit of talking about.
Sure. I mean, I think we would be hard-pressed to find a family that doesn't have at least a television, if not multiple televisions and multiple cell phones and computers throughout the house. And the impact that has on sleep is related to the way that the brain interprets light, and specifically the blue spectrum of light, which enters through your eyes through a direct connection with the suprachiasmatic nucleus and the hypothalamus. And the reason I mentioned that particular portion of the brain is because that's basically where the clock inside the brain resides and tells your physical body when it's time to prepare for sleep, when it's time to go to sleep, and when it's time to wake up. And the impact that too much screen time in the evening can have is that it will limit that system in the brain from being able to start with the sleep cycles. And it's related to hormonal influence with melatonin. It's related to an activating system in the brainstem. And then it's also related just to the, I guess I would refer to it as the exciting nature of a lot of programming that's available that can be stimulating and arousing just by virtue of the content that's being watched.
Maybe to just be a devil's advocate, so to speak, what about something like music or other stimuli that might be an environment that somebody may get in the habit of using? What would you say if, let's say, their sleep patterns are working well versus somebody who is trying to figure out a way to get into a sleep pattern? Am I clear there?
Sure. No, absolutely. And I think let me answer with an example. So if you have a young child, say a newborn, and the only way you can get him or her to sleep is by rocking them, the rocking motion can actually be what becomes the association for that infant between being awake and being able to fall asleep. So over time, if that's done consistently enough, or in some cases too often, that can be the only key which allows that infant to transition from awake into sleep. And I think a lot of families with young kids have experience with that. So that's where we get into what is being used as the association to allow that transition from wakefulness to sleep. And it is very reasonable to explore association objects such as a noise machine, kind of background white noise. For some older patients, it can be music, even to the point of podcasts with limited duration. Or it can be some object that's in the bedroom, perhaps a nightlight or some key that is consistently used as being present during that period in which the infant, the toddler, or the child goes from being awake to asleep. So I would actually say that using some of the non-visually stimulating objects to aid in sleep transition can actually be an excellent way to kind of improve bedtime routines with some of the younger patients.
Mm-hmm. Traditionally, people have often used reading to go to sleep at night. Mm-hmm. Older individuals, maybe teens.
Yeah, one of my favorites. And that actually is one of the foundations of some of the patterns of how to improve your sleep at night when you have young kids, is establishing a very consistent, and it doesn't matter necessarily what exactly you do, but a very useful one that I recommend to my patients would be bath time, brushing your teeth time, book time, and then bedtime. And the nice thing about reading is you have a lot of interaction between the parents and the child. So you can kind of direct the tone of the book, the voice in which it's being read, kind of bring down the general level of activity that's going on in the household. And all of those things can be incredibly powerful in kind of persuading your younger child that it's time for bed and that you're going to be going to sleep shortly.
So what I hear you say is that the recommendations, especially for children and even for adults, I guess I should say, is there's establishing a good, consistent routine is one of the really cruxes of the whole story.
So it is. And there is not just anecdotal evidence to support that, but there's a lot of research when it comes down to circadian rhythms that suggests that routines are not just about getting into the habit of doing something, but there's a physical underpinning to it. So what I mean by that is the circadian pattern within the brain is actually a little bit longer than the light-dark cycle in the outside world. So that circadian rhythm is about 24.2 hours, where our light-dark cycle is 24 hours. So our brain requires external influence to tell our brain when it is time to wake up and when it is time to sleep. If we don't have those, we will gradually and forever go to sleep a little bit later, wake up a little bit later, go to sleep later, wake up later, and so on and so forth. And so the major influences on those centers in the brain are exposure to light, which we talked about, and that's why screen time can have such a major impact. Energy levels throughout the day, so how active are you when you wake up? The timing of waking up so that your body clock can start counting towards when is it time for me to go to sleep? And then finally, some hormonal influence, particularly with melatonin, that can help both time and actually induce sleep onset later on in the evening.
I'm gonna jump ahead just for a second in my thinking about the program, because it's something I don't want to forget. And I remembered it may have been at the last time we did a program with you, but somewhere I heard somebody say, and I hope I'm not misremembering or misquoting, that once you lose some sleep, let's say you go a couple of days where you don't take much sleep, and the idea is, well, I'll just sleep more on the weekend. Is that a fallacy, or can you catch up on sleep?
So that is catch up sleep or sleep debt is probably the most common practice that there is amongst all of us, mm-hmm. right? You don't have to go to work on Saturday morning. The alarm clock becomes the bane of your existence, and so you recover on Saturday and Sunday. The way that can negatively impact your circadian pattern is that we have this inherent underlying drift towards staying up later and waking up later. That's that mismatch between internal circadian patterns and external cues. So it's very easy for us to tend to become night owls if unchecked. So what happens there is, as you stay up late on Friday and Saturday night, but then know on Sunday night that you need to get up early for work or for school in the morning, it is very difficult to turn that clock backwards. Mm-hmm. We refer to that as a circadian advancement. And as all of us know, it is easy to stay up late if you're, say, doing something that you're enjoying. But it is very difficult to go to bed early and then will yourself to sleep. Mm-hmm. And that's because of that physiologic circadian pattern that can be pushed backwards, but is very difficult to move forwards.
So it's not a fact that you accumulate a permanent sleep debt over time if you don't sleep as much during the week and then try to catch up on night. It's just that it's really hard to do.
So correct. And I think it goes back to the theme of consistency. So what happens is, if you have an inconsistent pattern mm-hmm. on your work days versus your weekends, having that going back and forth between the cycles can make your early week wake-ups very difficult. There's also the idea of preservation of certain stages of sleep. So earlier on, we had talked about sleep exists in non-REM and REM type sleep. And in the non-REM sleep, there is a particular stage called N3. It's also called slow wave or delta sleep, that is incredibly preserved by the body. And that is probably because there are some very important hormonal influences that occur during slow wave sleep that allow for growth, development, energy restoration, that allow us to feel rested and well when we wake up in the morning. So the brain preserves that if you go for long periods of sleep deprivation or sleep debt. The other interesting phenomenon is what's called REM rebound. And if you go through long periods of either chronic sleep deprivation or acute sleep deprivation, what we'll see on subsequent nights is that you get this very large increase in the percentage of time spent in REM sleep, which also suggests a very important role to REM sleep in the overall function of your brain and thus your body.
All right, so the next question I'm going to ask is the most common sleep problem I think pediatricians get. And I'm talking about now your parents, particularly it's your first child, your home, breastfeeding or bottle feeding. I have a bias that this happens more in breastfeeding, but we won't get into that. But, all right, my baby goes to sleep. I've got that figured out, but they won't stay asleep. So this is an issue that is has no regard necessarily to age, but let's address infants, and then we can talk about older children and even adults that may have similar problems.
So for infants, I have an unfortunate response for you, and that is between the ages of just born and about 4 to 6 months, there is no consolidation of the patterns of sleep. And so what that means is it's referred to as polyphasic. So there will be basically random periods of sleep and random periods of wakefulness that are distributed throughout the day in no particular fashion. That's what makes having newborns so difficult, is that their sleep schedule has absolutely no bearing, or I would say respect, for the sleep needs of mom or dad. Now, that does gradually mature. So fortunately, it is typically a self-limited report. And then by the age of about 4 to 6 months, you start getting consolidation, which means patterns of sleep usually start off as biphasic. So you'll have two large blocks of sleep throughout the night and then an additional block of sleep during the day, which is, you know, a benefit to mom and dad, but it's kind of a natural progression. Now, if you go forward a little bit further in life and you, say, have a four-year-old who now goes to sleep but will not stay asleep throughout the night, I think the key question is if there is any obvious environmental trigger that could be limiting him or her from actually maintaining sleep throughout the night. And the usual suspects are typically what I can end up pointing a finger at. That's noise throughout the household. That's too many devices in the bedroom. That's an uncomfortable room. The temperature is off. Something that is a kind of a simple and a clear trigger. And if that's not the case, then the other question is there an internal cause? When we say organic medical conditions, that could be something related to a physical system within the body that's causing an outward problem. Or is it something that is kind of a learned behavior that needs to be essentially unlearned so that they, this toddler, again, we're talking about, can go back to a normal pattern and distribution of sleep?
All right. So what I heard you say is that up through 4 to 6 months of age, it's not unusual for babies to awaken during the night. So when is it appropriate and how would you go about training a baby to try to sleep longer at night?
So the behavioral interventions or sleep training are quite varied. And this would be a topic that if you were to do an internet search on or phone a friend for input, you would get as many answers as questions you would ask. So it's actually been very, very thoroughly studied because one of the concerns has always been if you, and I say this in quotes, sleep train your child, are you causing or inflicting any type of psychological or even physical harm? And so when we refer to sleep training, we would talk about the extinction method, which is essentially cry it out. There are less severe forms of that where you can gradually extend the amount of times you go into the bedroom to console the child. And then there are parental co-sleeping methods. There are habits and the patterns that we've been talking about earlier. But essentially, all of these things are different interventions that parents can do to improve the duration and the quality of sleep of their child. And in every single study, which is systematic reviews or randomized controlled clinical trials, there has been absolutely no evidence that these interventions result in either short-term, medium-term, or long-term harm. And actually, quite the opposite has been found, is that overall global assessments of patient satisfaction, parental satisfaction, overall sense of well-being within the household consistently improves with these, all of them, interventional methods for improving sleep. And I think I'd just like to touch that there was a very large trial which was done as a follow-up in 2013. It initially began as the infant sleep study, and then the follow-up was titled the kid sleep study, and it was just under 200 patients were assessed with multiple different mechanisms of sleep training, all of which showed, in general, improved outcomes with, again, all of the different types of sleep training that were performed.
I saw a study just the other day, and I meant to send it to you, and I forgot about it, Dr. Dodge. But they even went so far as to measure cortisol levels in infants, with cortisol being a marker for stress, and found no significant changes related to the extinction process, which was another way to try to get a little bit more evidence that this seems to be okay, at least from a stress standpoint.
So correct. And the reason, the kind of the underlying pursuit of using cortisol levels is because researchers have been trying to put a physical marker on what was otherwise being reported by questionnaires. And so the concern was, if you have this visible display of improvement, does that actually mean that from a physical perspective, things have improved overall? The recent cortisol-related study, I don't know if I've read that one, but there have been multiple in the past that have looked specifically at that. You can measure cortisol as a serum analysis, or you can do it by saliva sampling. And all of them have showed that the increase in cortisol levels is either non-significant or non-present related to interventional methods of sleep training, including the, you know, the more cut and dry extinction, which is essentially the cry it out method. There was just no connection with what seemed to be abnormally elevated cortisol levels.
Let's advance a little bit further into age with the same problem. An individual, let's say adolescent, or if you want to, you could take an older adult, says they have no trouble going to sleep. They seem to wake fairly commonly, perhaps at closely to the same time each night, and then have a difficult time getting back to sleep, 1 or 2 hours. What does that make you think of? How would you approach that?
So this, I think, can be applied to all ages, even if we're talking more about the older adolescent into adult population. So there's two things that happen during the night. We initially have to fall asleep, which is called the onset of sleep, and then we have to stay asleep, which is called maintenance of sleep. Usually, if somebody has difficulty staying asleep throughout the night, they also have a coexisting problem falling asleep during the night. And that would suggest that there is a behavioral or what we would call an above the ears or an in the head type of an issue, which is a learned pattern that is problematic to both fall asleep and stay asleep. If it is specifically trouble staying asleep throughout the night with no difficulty getting to sleep in the first place, then one of the first things I start to look for is an underlying organic condition. So again, that would be a medical condition that will be limiting that individual's ability to maintain sleep. Because like we talked about earlier on with the different stages of sleep, the body tends to crave this normal cyclic pattern of sleep throughout the night. And so it's unusual for it to be persistently disrupted with no other good reason. And so that would be somebody that I would start to look for other underlying conditions that could be associated with recurrent arousals. Those would be things like obstructive sleep apnea, limb movement disorders, persistent limb movement disorders such as restless leg syndrome, and then a couple less common or referred to as rhythmic movement disorders that can disrupt your ability to stay asleep at night.
So before we came on the air, I had an email that asked that very same question. So it sounds to me like the email was addressing an adult. That adult probably should go and talk with someone if they're having this problem consistently, and particularly keep in mind that there may be some organic reason for this that can be addressed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think something I'd like to point out here is that the usual presentation for a common condition, such as obstructive sleep apnea, which I see frequently, in female patients is almost always I have difficulty maintaining sleep throughout the night, which is interesting because men typically present by force of their bed partner pushing them into the clinic for an evaluation, whereas women don't have near as much of this overt display of gasping, choking, morning headaches, waking up feeling like they're being suffocated. It's usual, look, I think I spontaneously woke up, it happens throughout the night, and I really don't have any idea why.
Ross, I can understand how an organic problem might wake you. I have a little harder time understanding why it may continue to keep you awake. I would guess if I had obstructive sleep apnea, restless leg or something, it wakes me up. But then my thought would be, my reason for not getting back to sleep is I'm worried about something.
Well, sure.
But is that not necessarily true?
No, absolutely. And so it depends upon the degree of the arousal.
Okay.
So if we have these cortical arousals, so that are visible to us on an EEG portion of a sleep study, and we see that they wake the brain up for a very short period of time, defined as at least 3 seconds, that does not necessarily have to wake the individual up to the point of where they're up and they need to go use the restroom or they're aware of their surroundings. If it does wake somebody up for a full arousal during the night, in the context of obstructive sleep apnea, it's usually to the point that it causes significant degree of disturbance in their sleep. And so the example I will use frequently in clinic is, imagine if you're laying there in bed and somebody sneaks into your room and covers your nose and your mouth so you cannot pull air into your lungs. Mm-hmm. If you're awake, that's extremely distressing. And if you're asleep, you fortunately still have all those alarm centers in the brain that are going to recognize that there's a problem with normal breathing. And so part of the response to that trigger is, aside from just the deregulation you get in oxygenation and CO2 levels as part of your ventilation at night is you can actually trigger the emergency system in the brain, that sympathetic nervous system, which will increase your blood pressure. It increases your heart rate. You get this kind of sympathetic tone increase throughout the body. And so you can literally wake up in a startled sensation of fright, which has a lot of carryover effects. Some of the hormones that are released, they just don't disappear within seconds. And so often you will have patients say, look, I kind of gasp, or I find myself awake, and I just cannot return back to sleep. And so because there are so many health consequences associated with obstructive sleep apnea, that's something I focus in on pretty quickly if I get a sense of a history like that in my clinic.
So to follow this a little bit better, and here I'm trying to educate myself, but at the same time help our listeners get educated. If we go back to, let's say we're talking about 4-, 5-, and 6-year-old that gives the same kind of questions, goes to sleep okay, but wakes up. Now what a 4-, 5-, or 6-year-old may do is he may not sit there and not do anything. He's going to get out of bed more often than not and go in and see the family. So I should be focusing in that particular situation, again, about organic things, if I'm hearing yours right.
So you are correct. And the other thing I think to comment on for kids is that it all goes back to the association that that patient has that allows them to fall asleep. Mm-hmm. So adults typically don't need that. When we're tired, we fall asleep. But in this 4-, 5-, and 6-year-old, one of the things that I press families on from a history standpoint is how does your child actually get to sleep? What is it that is being done? What mechanism do you use? What is your pattern? And if there's not a consistent pattern, or if there's not something that I can confidently say is what that patient uses to get to sleep at night, then what I focus on and emphasize is more the sleep training perspective so that they can have this association object or routine that allows them to fall back asleep without getting up out of bed, without waking up mom and dad, without crying out in the middle of the night, which is usually a reflection of they just are now awake and aren't sure how to put themselves back to sleep without somebody else helping them.
All right. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a one-minute break, and then we'll continue our discussion on pediatric sleep issues with Dr. Ross Dodge. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our guest today is Dr. Ross Dodge. Dr. Dodge is Medical Director for Sleep Medicine at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, and he also sees patients of all ages with all kinds of sleep issues at Peak Neurology in Anchorge. And we're discussing sleep issues primarily from birth through adolescence. If you've got questions or comments, you can email us directly during this next 30 minutes or so at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally right now, 550-8433, or you can use our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9 p.m. on a Monday evening, you're listening to a taped broadcast, we won't be able to answer your questions, you can always go to the Line 1 archives at alaskapublic.org and listen to the program again or refer someone to listen to this this program. Where are we? Let's talk about medications. That question gets asked to pediatricians. Get asked to you, and if you don't mind bringing in the issue of melatonin.
Sure. And this is an area of particular interest to me. And it's because once I started having children of my own, I became aware of the magnitude of the problem when you walk into the grocery store or to your neighborhood pharmacy. And so think for a minute about the last time you went to go pick up a cold and flu medication at your local grocery store, and almost equaling in volume the amount of remedies and supplements and treatments for coughs, colds, and flus is the sleep aid section in the grocery store. So a huge volume of over-the-counter medications are marketed directly to improve sleep problems, mostly for adults, but there's a lot of carryover on the pediatric side of things also. So almost every over-the-counter sleeping medication that you can purchase is going to be some form of Benadryl. It's also known as diphenhydramine. And the way it works for sleep is it's actually a side effect of the intended use of the medication that leads to sleepiness. Histamine is one of the primary neurotransmitters that leads to wakefulness. It's in huge quantities in the reticular activating system in the brainstem. And it allows us to stay awake. It's in high levels throughout the day. The antihistamines, which are used primarily for allergies, inflammation, has the unintended consequence of blocking that histamine effect in the brain, which causes you to feel drowsy. One of the major problems with using antihistamines for sleep is that you quickly develop a dependence. So the usual dose that you would start within a couple of days will become less effective or no longer effective at all. And over time, you can have a carryover and additive effect where some of the long-term side effects, the significant degree of grogginess the next day, the cognitive slowing, or I just can't regain my thought processes quickly, is quite common with the over-the-counter sleep aids and sleep medications. So what I generally counsel all of my patients on, but specifically my younger patients, is that the over-the-counter medications, especially if used consistently, should really be avoided. Those are the cases that I think should have a discussion with their pediatrician, with their healthcare provider, or with myself, to look at alternative ways about routinely getting somebody to sleep. And there was one major study, was called the TIRED trial. It was published in 2006, which was actually stopped early. The Data Safety Monitoring Board, after about 2 weeks of this evaluation, the evaluation, which I forgot to mention, was looking at how effective is Benadryl for sleep in younger patients. And after 2 weeks, they actually had to discontinue and stop the trial because there were more patients in the placebo arm, so were receiving a medication but was not the active ingredient, that did better and improved than there were in the actual treatment arm. And then, of course, there were a lot of secondary effects that were measured in terms of poor sleep, disrupted sleep continuity that were seen in the patients treated for more than two or three nights with the Benadryl. You had also mentioned melatonin, which I think is, I know is the most widely utilized compound, non-prescription compound for sleep problems. And, you know, melatonin is probably the most misunderstood compound that there is in the sleep community. So melatonin actually works not as a hypnotic, which would mean a medication that makes you feel sleepy and puts you to sleep. It has far more impact on manipulating the circadian patterns and the timing of your circadian cycles. So melatonin is a natural substance which is secreted by the pineal gland, which we had talked earlier about the suprachiasmatic nucleus, has multiple direct connections with the SCN, I'll refer to it as. And so what happens is, as environmental light begins to decrease, there's a phenomenon referred to as the dim light melatonin onset. So that external light begins to go down. In other words, the sun starts to set and your brain begins to adapt its early sleep processes by having a rising degree of melatonin secreted by the pineal gland. So the idea in over-the-counter use is that if you augment that with melatonin, you will be able to fall asleep just a little bit faster or easier. The problem is that melatonin that's taken over-the-counter is typically way higher in overall dosage than the natural secretion of melatonin from the pineal gland. And the reason that becomes problematic is we have to metabolize medications or drugs that we take that are not endogenous or are from within. And the timing of how long melatonin is available in your bloodstream can actually have the opposite effect in timing your sleep cycles if you take too much of it. So for multiple reasons, you know, I think that use of any over-the-counter medication should first be with a conversation with your healthcare provider, just to make sure that A, it's safe, and B, you're actually getting the intended consequence or the intended effect of the medication that you're taking.
You had mentioned a couple of times at pediatric rounds where you've done talks to pediatricians about this, and I think on the last program that the public needs to be aware that over-the-counter preparations, I'm going to choose my words carefully here, commonly do not have exactly the amount or substance that is said to be in it.
This is very true, you know, and I understand entirely the, you know, the political correctness of your response, you know, but I think that the flip side to that, being aware of the PC implications, is that, you know, these are widely utilized medications that can have consequences that are not beneficial. And this is a for-profit industry. I mean, many billions of dollars are made marketing things such as, you know, sleep easy, sleep well, sleep right, Z-Quil, and so on. But again, what I think I need to remind everybody out there of is that most of these medications are utilizing a side effect. So it is not the primary intention of the medication that's in the preparation for these sleeping pills. And it was, I want to say it was within the last calendar year where there was an expose at several large, well-known retailers and pharmacies where they had done analyses and evaluations of the content. And it wasn't specifically sleeping pills, but it was natural type remedies. And there was essentially little, no, or not the stated active ingredient that was in a lot of these over-the-counter available medications. And so I think it's, you know, like anything, it's a balance, and it should be taken as a point of caution that there are certainly very good benefits for lots of things you can get over the counter. But I think consumer awareness and kind of being a very proactive and asking questions about what you're taking and why you're taking it is always, always reasonable.
Do you think we see at northern latitudes or at high latitudes in either hemisphere more sleep problems, more pathology, if I were to use that word, related to sleep than other areas of the world where it's not such big swings throughout the year of light and dark?
Yeah, certainly. And, you know, as we had mentioned earlier, the primary driver of these internal circadian rhythms is exposure to external light. And as we have, you know, very short windows on the shoulder seasons where we have a normal distribution of light, and then in between we have quite extremes, and what that makes it more difficult for is for our circadian rhythms internally to manifest or to turn into normal sleep patterns at night. And so what we do have control of is our inside the house environmental light. And you know, that's where one of the things to, when you wake up in January and it's pitch black outside, you know, you can maintain a consistent sleep pattern, and you can augment that by flicking on all the lights throughout your house, or in some instances, actually buy a light box to boost the amount of light exposure you get first thing in the morning and maintain consistency of those patterns. On the opposite end, during the summertime, what you do have control over is whether or not you let that light outside in your house come 8:30, 9 o'clock at night. And so there is an extreme degree of benefit to blackout curtains, shaded rooms, you know, avoiding outside spaces. And that doesn't mean you can't go have fun and have weekend nights where you, you know, do exactly what you want to do as late as you want. But if that becomes the rule, if that becomes a consistent approach, then it can be very difficult to maintain, hey, I feel good and I woke up easily on Monday morning when it's time to go back to work. So that's a balance. And a lot of that is, you know, personal decision making on behalf of the patient.
I have an email from a listener. It says, I've got a 12-year-old who falls asleep readily, 8:30 or 9 o'clock at night. Wakes up 5:30, 6 in the morning. During the night, they may wake and move around and even go into another room. They will readily fall asleep when riding in a car, and occasionally they sleepwalk. This is not a new occurrence. Does this suggest any particular kind of sleep disorder?
It could, but, you know, I think before saying this is a medical problem, the question I would ask is, how much sleep routinely does this individual get? So at 12 years old, you know, most children are going to need somewhere between 9 and 12 hours of sleep per night. So typically more than kids of that age range are typically getting. Chronic sleep deprivation, even if it's, you know, 7 or 8 hours per night, where they need 9 or 10 hours per night, can accumulate over time. And one of the most common triggers for things like sleepwalking, excessive daytime somnolence, or those kind of unintentional naps during the day is simple sleep deprivation. And so before I go into a more robust medical evaluation for patients like this in clinic, I say, look, we just need to kind of prove that this isn't simple things being common. And let's spend about 2 or 3 weeks where we pay very close attention to the patterns of sleep and the duration of sleep. And then if the problem remains persistent, it's very reasonable to do a little bit more in-depth medical evaluation with some testing.
Yeah, I would think that that's particularly true in the summertime here, where light is we're light for a long time. We're up and active quite a bit, and then we may be getting up earlier. So a lot of these parasomnias, if I dare use the word, may be worse in the summertime here than in the winter. Is that reasonable thinking, or any evidence to suggest that?
Nope, that absolutely is not just reasonable, but it's, you know, it's what I find in my practice, and it's also what's suggested in the medical literature. And there's a twofold reason for that. Is summertime in Alaska with lots of light exposure generally leads to shorter overall periods of total sleep time. And we're more likely to have a lot of environmental triggers around us. There's more cars on the road. There's more people outside. People mow their lawns at 11 o'clock at night. So there's far more reasons for normal environmental stuff to kind of creep into the bedroom and limit our ability to stay asleep throughout the night. So, yeah, on both accounts, you are correct.
So I've got an excellent, interesting question from a listener, but I want to ask another question before I get to that one. And because I started the program by talking about sleep deprivation and health, can you talk briefly about what we know about health issues specifically? And I'm going to say not getting enough sleep. I'm sure we could talk about sleep problems of getting too much sleep too, but let's limit it to not getting enough sleep. What do we really know here?
So I will answer in the context of younger patients, because I had just a few months ago given a grand rounds presentation specifically on the neurocognitive impairment and consequence of sleep disorders. And so what I mean by neurocognitive impairment is daytime problems that are either in mental processing, intelligence, emotional stability, and how does that relate to sleep problems at night. And the clearest association between sleep issues and daytime functioning for kids actually is in the realm of neurocognition. So we certainly are concerned about things like blood pressure, cardiovascular heart disease, risk of diabetes, conditions like obesity. But the usual manifestation is, say, mild to moderate sleep apnea, a chronic insufficient total sleep time. What we get is a representation of a patient who has trouble with emotional regulation, who might be struggling to keep up with their peers in school, and has a really tough time in reacting to complex tasks. And if you put all of those kind of high-level functioning processes together, it's typically termed as fluid intelligence. And that fluid intelligence is usually what seems to have the most impairment with chronic sleep issues at night. And when I say sleep issues, I want to specify, I mean, this is all-encompassing, whether you're not getting enough sleep based on guideline recommendations, or if you have a medical problem that's leading you to not be able to get enough sleep despite, you know, the availability to have a full night's rest.
The person you described as a young child could easily be confused for a child with attention deficit disorder.
Correct. And so that is a loaded question because there is very conflicting reports about whether or not that condition is overdiagnosed, whereas it could simply be chronic sleep deprivation. And so, you know, the most direct way to answer that question is you need to sit down and talk with the family.
Right.
And that by no means means that the diagnosis of ADHD or a multitude of other behavioral disturbances are not real. Clearly, it is a condition and it can benefit from treatment from all aspects. But I think the best way for me to sum it up is those individuals, regardless of whether or not they have a primary sleep problem, will be more adversely impacted by not receiving an appropriate, adequate amount of sleep. And so that should be a very key part of their treatment plan.
Right. It's a complex thing. Like many psychosocial neurologic problem is a kid who does have true attention deficit and responds very well to treatment often still may also have sleep problems as well. So the chicken or the egg issue can be important to decipher, to figure out.
Yeah, you know, in clinic, when I'm faced with the chicken or the egg problem, I try and tackle both. And, you know, I think that when it comes to sleep is you're almost always correct in saying, look, we can make sleep better and we can assess for a primary sleep condition that could be coexisting with all the other issues that we just spoke about.
All right. So here's the email. Tell me what you think of this one. So someone emailed it and said they have a family member that speaks in a foreign language that nobody understands, including the person who is sleeping during their sleep time. You ever heard of that one before?
So I tell you, I get a little bit nervous every time you say I have a doozy of a question and then you make me wait 5 minutes before it's relayed to me.
Just helping your anxiety.
Yeah. So talking during your sleep, which we refer to as somniloquy, is considered a parasomnia, but it is one of the most benign variants. We can actually categorize parasomnias based on whether they occur during non-REM sleep or REM sleep. The benign ones typically occur during non-REM sleep, which is when people talk in their sleep. And the significance of it being a foreign language, I would have no idea.
Okay.
But what I would say is it would be interesting to obtain maybe some recordings with a portable recorder,
right,
or, you know, an iPhone audio.
Right.
And see if it actually is a foreign language. Almost always somniloquy is gibberish. So mm-hmm. You can't actually make out words, or you can occasionally put a phrase together, but, you know, typically it is random vocalizations that don't really coalesce mm-hmm. into anything.
Yeah, one of the advantages of the easy ability to record and get videos now is, at least in pediatrics, it's wonderful to get some videos of kids sleeping, or do they truly have sleep apnea. We have parents bring in these recordings all the time. It's been very helpful.
Yeah, actually, today I had a phone call from a pediatrician in town related to noise that was being made during the respiration cycle at night. And we were, just by having her relay to me the timing and the quality of the sound that was being made, and we were, you know, I was pretty confident in saying, like, I do not think this is obstructive sleep apnea based on, you know, this, and this. So absolutely. I mean, talk about a cheap way to expedite a diagnosis. It's fantastic in clinic.
What about sleep studies? What goes on in a sleep study? Who can have a sleep study? Who can't have a sleep study?
Sure. So the only people who cannot have a sleep study are those who cannot sleep, because then we monitor a patient twiddling their thumbs and staring at the camera all night long. So it's a little glib. Essentially, anybody can have a sleep study. Earlier on in the discussion, we had talked about the development of patterns of sleep, and usually by about 3 to 4 months of age, there is a representation of patterns of sleep that we can evaluate on EEG component of a polysomnogram, which is a sleep study, which means that as young as about 3 to 4 months is we can do a sleep study and get results that would be reflective of what an adult evaluation would be. A lot goes into a sleep study. For my younger patients, equally important to the study itself is what we refer to as the desensitization, which means we got to get the child into the sleep lab. We have to show them the equipment, show them the bed, and let them anticipate what's coming so it is not a worrisome, problematic, traumatic event that occurs at night. We look at brain patterns, eye movements, activity of the jaw muscles, heart rate, breathing patterns, airflow through the nose, airflow through the mouth, inspiration through the chest, through the lungs, movement of the extremities, and all of this gets compiled. This is all physical data that they then gets turned into, you know, is this normal sleep? And if not, this is the most likely contributor to it being not a normal sleep.
We've just got a couple of minutes. I'm going through my notes to see what we should talk about. One thing I have get questions about occasionally, and you had mentioned that something you might want to mention is that a child who rocks their head every night before they go to sleep, or I've seen kids maybe an 8 or 9, 10-month-old who lays in bed, usually with their legs curled up underneath them, and rocks and hits their head against the baby bed or something to go to sleep. Is this normal?
So surprisingly, yes, is the answer. Those are referred to as rhythmic movement disorders. And, you know, I find it a bit unfortunate that they're categorized as disorders because, you know, these observations are normal, and they're also normal in up to 60% of pediatric patients. So around the age of 9 months is where we'll see kind of this peak of these rhythmic movement conditions, the most common of which is referred to as head banging syndrome, jocatio nocturnus capita. Second to that, we'll see a lot of body rocking. And it, you know, a lot of this stuff kind of ties into things we've talked about earlier on. And the thinking behind these rhythmic movement conditions is that they're actually self-consolation ways for the patient to transition themselves from wakefulness into sleep. Almost exclusively, these conditions resolve spontaneously. And the only time that they would lead to medical concern is if they cause injury to the patient or to other people that may be in the bed or in the bedroom with the patient. So, you know, aside from those self-injurious behaviors, these are things to be observed, make sure that it's a very safe sleeping environment, and then know that they are almost likely going to resolve by the age of 12 to 18 months.
We've got less than 2 minutes. One of my other favorite efforts to get information out is to ask about nocturnal bedwetting, bedwetting at night only. Is this a sleep disorder?
So it is. It can become a sleep disorder depending on the age of the patient and how long it's been a problem. So there is a large school of thought that considers enuresis or bedwetting to be not a disorder, but actually just a physical immaturity of a system that takes up to the age of about 4, 5, or 6 years old to mature to the point where you can control your urination mechanism at night. In the context of other ongoing problems, daytime urinary problems, pain issues with urination, or other signs suggestive of, say, obstructive sleep apnea or movement disorders at night, typically will provide parents with, you know, no more than reassurance. Usually by about the age of 5 or 6 years old, the prevalence is reduced to about 5 to 10% of the population. By puberty, it's resolved in almost all individuals with a persistent prevalence of about 2 to 3% beyond the age of 13 or so. So, you know, again, what I would say is bedwetting is almost always benign. It should involve a review for other things that could be causing it. It's not a primary condition. But for the most part, it's something that can be a little bit frustrating, but will resolve on its own with time.
Thanks again, Dr. Dodge. It's been a pleasure. A very fast hour.
Yeah, unbelievable. I really appreciate you having me on the show, and hope we provided some good insight for your listeners out there. And again, I'm just, you know, very grateful to have been invited.
All right. If you want to continue to address the discussion on pediatric sleep issues, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link on our website at alaskapublic.org. Next week, we're going to get back into AIDS and HIV and learn some of the information that's very important as we approach HIV testing day, June 27th. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron engineered today's program. Eric Bork is our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.